Hello, Cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 163 of Cyclocross Radio. It's another media pit with Michael and Zach, and we're going to get to that as soon as I tell you about the Wide Angle Podium Network and the donor drive. We are in the middle of our annual donor drive, and I know, please don't fast forward now because I need your ears, and I'm going to keep it short, but I'm going to, and to the point. But here's the deal. If you want the network to continue, if you want to continue listening to the Slow Ride Podcast and Bike Shop CX and the Consummate Athlete, the Gravel Lot, Grodio, Cyclocross Radio, if you like those shows, we need your help. It's not as cut and dry as it may seem that we're just looking for extra money. What we need is member support to keep the network afloat. So please, go to wideanglepodium.com/donate. If you take any value out of the content that we provide, if you listen to any shows during the weeks, please consider becoming a member. $5 a month, $10 a month, on from there. We do have swag available. We'll send you out some cool gifts for becoming a member. But more importantly than that, I don't think we, in these pitches on the shows, we're really serious enough about what this means. And this is a business for us, and to continue to have this business run, it can't run at a loss. You know, we've done that. We're in fourth year now, and we really need the help of the community to continue putting out shows. So please, wideanglepodium.com/donate, or just go to wideanglepodium.com, click on the donate button. Once you get to the level that you want to donate on a monthly basis, you can choose the shows that you wish to support, and they get a percentage of that. And that, I think, is something that needs to be made clear, that some of the shows have decided to donate money or do different things with the share that they get. That's kind of on them and where they are financially. That's if they feel like they can do that, that's awesome. But that's not a reflection of where the network is at. And the network needs that money to keep the servers on and keep the shows coming out. And all the things that we want to do for you comes out of those dollars. So please, it's only a small percentage of you right now who donate. We need to grow that. We're looking for 200 new donors in this time period that's running out. We're not there yet. And that's going to be some difficult decisions to make if we can't reach those numbers. So please, wideanglepodium.com, donate, become an even better cyclocross friend. Okay, let's do this. Episode 163, Cyclocross Radio. It is the Media Pit with Zach and Michael, and we are doing it right now. All right, here we are with another episode of the Media Pit, joined by Michael and Zach. Lots to talk about. Lots to talk about, from what's going on with the World Cups to the actual World Cup in Switzerland, and then some domestic racing with a race I'm close to in DCCX. So let's get it started. I think I'm not looking at the agenda. Where are we starting, Michael?
Well, Bill, I got to say, I'm burning up over here. Oh, and
you're not even a dad.
I know.
You can't do that.
This is two episodes in a row.
That's going to happen every episode you have me on, Bill. I'm sorry. I hope you can...
I have you on. This is the Media Pit. This is all of us. I'm not taking responsibility for this.
Okay. All right. Well, I think, puns aside and dad jokes aside, I think we wanted to really kick off the show with the big news. It's been around for a couple weeks now, but just the future of World Cups, and with the Flanders Classics taking over rights to the World Cups next year. And they released a schedule of up to 16 World Cups, which is, do some math, what is that, 4 months in a row?
Yeah, Zach, I think you actually published that article pretty much as it was written in Cyclocross magazine. So what's the rundown? Do we get any time off to have some other races, or is just the whole calendar now World Cups?
Yeah, I mean, well, Michael mentioned that it's been out there. I think when the news initially broke that they were, that Flanders Classics was taking over the World Cup starting, they said either 14 or 16. And so I think we looked at that and we're like, that is a lot of races. And so last week, the UCI released the, is like a draft schedule. And we saw what that means. And literally, I used the word literally when we published it. There's literally a race, World Cup scheduled every Sunday between October 11th and January 24th, with the exception of Continental Championships and National Championships. So, you know, the implications are, and then there's like one on November 1st, which suggests that Copenberg is going to be one. I don't know. You know, there's one scheduled for the day after Zolder, which I don't know which race from Curse Period is going to be in there. And then it's kind of heated up because Sven Ness actually has been kind of leading the charge in Europe, because basically he's asking what's going to happen to the Super Prestige in the DVV. How are they going to exist?
Yeah, doesn't Flanders own one of those? Don't they own like the Super Prestige?
That's a good question. Galazzo was a big owner of a number of the races. They're kind of like the other big player.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
And I think that that's part of this. But, I think what we have to deal with in the U.S., you know, looking at that schedule, is if we are going to have U.S. World Cups, I mean, this whole early season thing's done, right? I mean, they're not going to happen in September.
No, September's out, and it's, the block format is gone too. You know, so they're still talking about doing at least, it's either 8 or 9 countries, which suggests half of them will be in Belgium. But like, the block system kind of worked because like you had the U.S. block, you know, you put two races together and it gives people from, I don't know, the rest of the world, an excuse to be in Europe, to be in these locations, you know, at a given period of time, for set, like kind of like the mountain bike World Cups, right? You go for a 2-race block, you go back and do your thing, you come for, but now it's like they're every weekend. So yes, that does definitely put a crimp on, or has an effect, will have an effect, could have an effect on the U.S. World Cups.
Yeah, I just want to just come out and say that I'm like totally against this plan. Like, I just want that to be known. It's I don't understand how anything else is supposed to survive. And like, I just, 16 races in a series, to me is too long. Like, I feel like the narrative is just way too long, and that I think 9 is actually a pretty good number, and you can see stories sort of progress from the beginning to the end, riders sort of come into form, peak, and then win. But 16 just seems like, you could be Vanderpool and you could miss the first third of the season, and then you come in the end and you win. And like, where is that? Like, what is that from like the consumer's perspective? Like, who is this for? Who is making sense to? Because you know, from Sven and it looked like Ellie, and Klaus. At least I'm like really want to. I don't want to say things wrong, guys. It's not Eli, it's Ellie and Klaus. Like the riders, even the riders don't like it. So like who? So A, are you guys a fan of the schedule? And B, like who is this for? Who is this serving?
I will say that just looking at the Flanders Classics group, they run 16 premier road races, and I feel like somehow they figured that's the magic number, but like road racing is, as we know, starts in what, February, and ends in January, so there's no real, you know, break there, and it's just 16 isn't that big of a number when you're taking into consideration 11 months out of the year, as opposed to cyclocross, which, you know, as you know, people get mad that it starts in the end of August now and goes until March. So I think it's a much more condensed time, and it really is just just pushing everybody out of that marketplace. I mean, this is, you know, we talked about it. I mean, the biggest problem here is that the UCI is running the World Cups, and they are supposed to be the governing body, and they're also the biggest bully as far as race organizer goes. They have the biggest series, and they get to make the rules to make sure that it is the biggest series. And it's, yeah, it's just not fair.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like it is about money, and it's about money to the new purchasing owner, it seems like, as well as the UCI. Because, I mean, they're essentially taking control of the calendar and saying, you know, we're going to control, you know, even though it's like, I guess if you divided it up, right, there's 8 World Cups, 8 Super Prestige, 8 DVV. So they're, you know, it's only 2/3, but, you know, what are those other series going to do? They're going to be stuck on the Saturdays before. And you saw even where there were complaints about having the Super Prestige and Boom the day before the Burn World Cup. And, you know, logistically, that's going to create issues. And, you know, how are races, like Sven mentioned, like Zonhoven and Degome and these other races, how are they going to survive?
Yeah, and wasn't Sven's, I think Sven's solution was 9 World Cups in 9 countries?
Yes, yes.
That to me sounds amazing. You can space them out. I mean, I think it would be, logistically it's tough. It makes it even harder for Americans to do that, especially if we're bringing in, I know that between Japan and China and wherever else, that Asia is clamoring to have one of these. I'm sure, you know, oceanic nations would probably want to do the same. So that's, logistically and financially, that's a huge ask for teams. But yeah, I don't know. This just seems untenable. And I think it really brings us to where we're at in the U.S., at least from an organizer's viewpoint, asking why are we even messing with this?
Yeah, I think so too. I think that it's almost like it becomes so big that you're just like, what is even the point of participating in that? And yeah, I mean, there is, like you said, there's a lot of feeling that they're gonna do 8 in Belgium, right, and then like stick a few up, maybe one in a few other countries, or for the continents, really, and then the rest are in Europe. And yeah, I don't know, that it just, like, I guess I have actually figured out who this is for. Just like, I kind of looked at the numbers and I see a kind of pattern evolve. It's for the Slow Ride podcast, the 16 World Cups. This is a long con number. By the super rookie. Yeah.
Well, and I think, like, I mean, one reason that I thought it was a topic worth discussing is, you know, we've heard, right, that both Trek and Jingle Cross are interested in doing World Cups again next year. But, you know, it creates a situation if there's 16 and you have this overall series, like, no European riders are going to come to those races, you know. And I think the appeal of it is, part of the appeal of it is getting those international riders. There is a bigger fan base that is interested in that. And we see that, right, in terms of like the interest in our publication and the work you do, Bill, because of that. But without it, it's just going to be, you know, kind of a provincial North American race that's called a World Cup. And I'm just kind of wondering, yeah, you know, there's that, but then it fits into this bigger narrative that we've been discussing of what's the future of American cross. And, you know.
Yeah, and it does. You get to a point then where the Europeans can say, we can sit that out, and if enough of them do that, especially if they're the top riders, it's okay. Let the North Americans have their day and go pretend that they're, you know, the best in the world and race for a World Cup. And then once they're done with that, we can get down to business and actually start the real World Cup season and have 14 races left. And even if you have some come over who, you know, want to try to, it's like when we used to have our local series in the DC area and we had one race that was a couple hours away and everybody just decided we're just not going to do that race and then it won't affect the series points at all. And then what would happen? Like, one person would be like, well, no one's going. I can go steal all these points. And then all of a sudden, the next person went, and then the next person registered. And then all of a sudden, we're all going down there, you know, just because it's we're just chasing points by going hours away to this one race that people weren't really thrilled about. And that's kind of what the U.S. ones have been, I think, when there were less World Cups. But now it just even takes that out of it. I mean, those points can be made up. And you could even go to the extreme that, well, if the Belgies all wanted to get together and say, let's just do the Belgian ones and not even worry about these other eight, then they just negate eight races and they can just race the Belgian races. Or they'll probably throw in a Dutch one, right? So it'll be like nine races they'll do, or 10. It's just...
No, we'll go to Switzerland too.
Yeah, sure. But it's just... Yeah, and they'll probably go to France too, because that's not too far of a drive as well. But yeah. But at the same time, yeah, it's just... I don't know. I don't see how this works. And it kind of, that part of it kind of bums me out, because it doesn't make me want to be a fan of the whole World Cup system. And I look at mountain bike World Cups and I really think that that is the perfect number. There's like six or eight World Cups, and it's what you were saying, Zach, it's these blocks. So you do these four different blocks and they can be like a month apart. And it's perfect. Everybody, and those are the biggest races. Everybody goes and they want to perform in the World Cups, and then they go to Switzerland or wherever else and race and go about their business. But it's not the entire sport, and that's what it's turning out to be for cyclocross.
Well, I think like even the structure we have right now has diluted them a little bit because of the approach some of the Euros are taking towards, you know, the World Cups. You're going to have a situation where, I don't know, like, you know, last year, Matthew Vanderpool did not win the World Cup overall, even though he was pretty dominant at the races that he actually showed up at. And, you know, the women's were still right. Kateryna Nash is leading the women's World Cup overall, but she might not even race the next cup. Although I guess Tabor is in her home country, so maybe she'll have an excuse to go back. But, you know, I don't know. It seems like it's already kind of fractured. We're on the mountain bike. It's look, everyone does every World Cup, like. That's just the kind of the way it is. Well, except
other,
for Vanderpool.
Other than Vanderpool, he's the outlier, yeah, in all of this.
He does his own thing. Yeah. You know, so I just kind of wonder, you know, even we're already seeing with the way some of the Euros, I feel like they've started to treat the U.S. World Cups, have already kind of broken that narrative. And it's like, I don't know, I'm kind of surprised. It's a lot of money they're kind of leaving on the table to take a trip to the U.S. to go race for 2 weeks. Like, you know, anyway, I guess you're seeing it happen already. But if there's 16, like you said, it's like...
So... Can I just, I do want to say that, like, I know, you know, in the past, and Bill, you mentioned that there was a desire that, you know, you had the UCI, who's the governing body of the world of cyclocross, and then them to also be putting on the series. I mean, have they sort of done their due diligence by distancing themselves by giving it to Flanders? Like, they're saying, hey, we're not going to promote the series anymore? I mean, that... Although it does, you know, it's going to the Flanders group, which is a very, you know, that's in cyclocross territory as it is already, where everything is. So it's not like it's going far. But I mean, do we think this was kind of in the right way to move with this and handing off the World Cup rights to this group?
Well, they're handing it off, but they're still making the rules, and the rules are biased towards the World Cups. And so, for instance, the other series, the Super Prestige, the Victoria Parkway series, we can't go above eight races. Eight races is the maximum for a UCI series. You can't have more than two UCI series in a country. But the World Cup can have 16, and the World Cup is going to take precedence over dates. And if there's a, you know, World Cup, you can't have a C1, I believe, in the same country on that same date. So they're still, you know, even though they may have handed off the management, they're still able to control the race structure and the rules and make sure that it is the dominant series in the world. So that's the part that they still have the power on.
Well, and they also increased the number of points that are available for the World Cups, and every World Cup counts towards your points. So you're limited by your buckets, and I think it's six C1s and six C2s, but every World Cup counts. And so from a UCI point standpoint as well, it's just overwhelmingly biased towards the World Cups as well.
Are you able to explain, because that's something that comes up a lot that I don't think people may completely understand, Zach, this whole like getting more points than you need in different level of competitions.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like, we're probably all kind of familiar with cross results. And so, you know, with cross results, I believe 5 of your last 10 races count, right, towards your cross results score. So that's kind of something we all kind of understand, right? It's your best 5 races. And so, you know, you have C2s. I think it counts, I want to say 6. So your 6 best total point totals from C2s count towards your UCI score. It might be 8. Your top 8 C1s, you know, scores count. And then all the World Cups. And so that's how you get your score. And if you probably heard people talking about Vanderpool going for the maximum score possible last year. He was short on the World Cups, but he was maxed out on wins in C1s. He had 8 wins in C1s, 8 wins in C2s. And so that was like 8 times 80 plus 8 times 40. And then the World Cups were worth 100 last year, I want to say. And so, right. So that's kind of how they were calculating that max score. And so if you have 16 World Cups that are now all worth 120, 200, I don't even know what the number is, you know, that number is going to far dwarf your maximum score that you can get from even the C1s that are
right.
worth
so
80
points. If you're good, or if you even you're in the middle and you want to pick a race, it's always like World Cup's always going to take precedence over anything else. And this is, you know, I'm glad that you explained that, because it also explains situations we've seen in the past when we have a dominant racer in the U.S. and we would see situations. I think that we see this with Powers, where he wouldn't race on Sundays, which were normally, if you had a double weekend in the U.S. and it'd be a C1 race on Saturday and a C2 race on Sunday, after he had already filled that bucket, you know, gotten wins in 6 races or whatever it is, there's really no need to race that, you know, other than just for the prize money. And I think for him in those years when he was dominant, it was, he would rather take those rest days and the points didn't matter. So I think that's something that people sort of have a grasp in, but thank you. That's good to get that explainer in there as well.
No, it came up last year at because Helen Wyman did the Friday night race before the World Cup, and she was explaining, she's like, oh, my C1 bucket is full, but I, you know, because they don't have a lot of C2s in Europe, she's like, I could really use the points in my C2 bucket. And I'm like, I was even like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah,
you're just making excuses for why you wanted to race on Friday night. But it turns out that she actually was looking for points.
Yeah, and she's still you'd listen to her when she's commentating at Jingle this year, and she's just mystified on why people wouldn't be racing. She's like, all these Europeans are here, they can get, you know, relatively easier points than they can at home at a race that they normally don't see. I don't understand why they're not racing it. They're not all going to win the World Cup. Why are they not racing Friday night? Yeah. So that's, yeah, it's interesting. What you got, Michael?
Sounds like part of the solution is just to get rid of all these points and these rankings. Just go to the algorithm system. Like, you know, like if you're basing your schedule off points and where you race, I mean, I'm kind of half joking, like listening to Stephen Hyde talk about in your podcast you just put out, Bill, talking about, you know, getting the points, and then, you know, that means like he would get a front row or a second row call up in the World Cup. And he even admitted that, you know, like maybe he shouldn't have been there, and that, like, you know, he would have been okay to be back, you know, in the fourth row. And it's like, man, what if we get rid of like call-ups based on some sort of ranking system? And I know that sounds completely crazy, but I'm just thinking, like, a lot of riders' movements are based off call-ups and rankings, which then, you know, rankings move you to different places too. But maybe that's like a one way to look at this problem, and someone can find a solution to that.
Well, I think that is kind of already happening, because, you know, the change from UCI ranking to, at least for, what is it, the first 24 spots in World Cups based on UCI World Cup ranking and not UCI points ranking, that's one big change. And I really, you know, when the Soviet Union started, I can already see Zach going, where is this going? You know, part of the stories was like when they were trying to implement communism, and part of that was having jobs for everyone. And there was this story about this company that, or this factory that made ball bearings, and this other factory that melted down ball bearings, and then they would just keep going from one factory to the other, so everybody kept having jobs. I kind of feel like that's where the U.S. race community is right now, in that they are still in this habit of just chasing these points around the U.S., and I think that the incentive to actually do that is gone, yet they don't know any other thing to do, so they just continue to do this. You know, I mean, I've talked about it before, but you look at World Cups. You can race as many C2s as you want. You can race as many C1s as you want. You're never getting into those front three rows anymore unless you actually perform in World Cup. So the best that you're doing is racing for fourth row back. We look at going to Worlds. And at one point in the U.S., if you had accumulated so many UCI points and were so far in ranked like in the 100 or 150 in the world, you had a better chance of being selected for a Worlds team. That's not there anymore. That's gone. So really, the only thing that you're chasing now is placement at Nationals. And if that's worth it for you to spend all of your budget to get a better gridding place in Nationals, more power to you. Awesome. I love seeing you at the races. But other than that, I think that, and that's part of why we're all sort of hand-wringing and figuring out what we want to do in the U.S., we need to find more incentive, Michael. So I think you're exactly right. That's already out there. There has to be a different incentive to have our best racers go to all of these races, because chasing points, I think, is gone.
I think that incentive is a disincentive towards the World Cups, and something that is homegrown in the States, self-contained, a series. Everybody said series, so whatever it is, but like just like, that's what it is. Like, that's where we need to go.
Well, and that's why, you know, we've kind of put it out there, and I know, and it's a really hard thing to grasp from many different levels, but it's just, I think we've talked about it publicly some, but definitely privately, it's really a conversation that's going around, in that for race organizers, what is the incentive for having a UCI race? And one of the incentives is kind of what we're talking about with the racers themselves. There is something to judge yourself against. If you are an athlete, you want to know where you stand against every other athlete in the world. And if you are a world-class athlete and you race cyclocross, the way to do that is to get UCI points. And if you get a certain, and this is totally out of what it gets for you, it's just a measuring stick.
Yeah.
And you can say, look, sponsors, I am the 120th person in the world who does the sports. I am better than everybody but 119 people. And that's something, right? That's something to hang your hat on. So if you take these races and you don't get UCI points, they're going to fall precipitously down that. The same thing from the organizer standpoint. I am part of a group that puts on a UCI race. That means something to us. This is year 13 of this race. It started as a local grassroots race one day. We worked up to 2 days. We worked up to UCI. That we look at that as an accomplishment, as boxes we're checking to in our own head say, we are a legitimate race. We are a world-class race. If we were to say next year, we don't want to be a UCI race, then that's scary. Because then you're taking all of that, what you've worked for, and saying, we're going to push that aside. And maybe we never get that back. We're one of two UCI series in the country. If we just say we don't want that anymore, that's scary. Because then somebody else can go get that and we just lose that opportunity. But on the other hand, if we do that, then we get all of this money back. We don't have to pay the UCI. And it's thousands upon thousands of dollars, like 10, 15, 20, whatever it is. And we also, and I love, you know, this is going to be Bill Hates Juniors again, I know, but in Europe, the juniors, the 17s or 18s, they are treated as pros more than they are in the U.S. So there is a prize structure set up in the UCI races for them to get more money than we're paying out to most adults. I personally am okay with not doing that. So if I don't have to pay next year $4,000 to, you know, kids whose moms and dads are bringing them to races and supporting them wholly, in my heart, I feel okay with that. And if I take that money and then give it to somebody who is, let's say, 23 or 24 years old, who is struggling in a UCI, what was a UCI level race, and getting top 10 or top 15, and I can say, here, at the end of the weekend, you got 15th and you got 9th, and here's $400. Thanks for coming to our race. That's huge. And that's how you change the sport in a big way and build something that you can say, hey, maybe it's better off if I just stay here and race these races. And we've said it, I'm going to stop talking in 2 seconds, but we said it a lot, but that's very similar to what the Epic Rides do, you know, that aren't even USA Cycling sanctioned races, and they're able to have these huge pots of money.
So I just have an interesting anecdote from Sunday that I think speaks to these two competing things that you kind of just described. So I was talking to, I went down to Chicago, great series, the Chicago Cross Cup, and they pay out pretty well. Like, they pay out 10 deep for their both elite fields. I think the winner of the men's and women's races gets over $300, which is approaching like UCI C2 pay, right? So you're talking about, like, is there this monetary incentive? Like, maybe you should travel to, like, you know, this is one way to get fields to come, is to give out more money that, for example, you might be paying to the UCI to register as a UCI race and stuff like that. But I talked to a rider who has just been absolutely destroying the Chicago Cross Cup fields. He takes home most weeks a nice check, finishes first or second. And he was like, you know what? He drove to Fayette Cross. He drove 10 hours to Fayette Cross to get his face kicked in, because he's like, I want to see where I stand. You know, and so for him, paying money, paying X amount of dollars, he was bitching about the 10-hour drive when he could just stayed home and taken home a nice paycheck. Like, $300 is not bad for 60 minutes of racing your bikes. So it's just interesting that there's these competing things that you need. If you do go the payout route, you still need fields, some way to define, this is going to attract the best. Here's where you should travel to, you know, when maybe you can make more money at home.
Well, that's the difference, I think, and that's why I mentioned at the end of my soapbox turn there was the Epic Rides, because they, over the series, give away hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's kind of the boost that you need, right? You need to get to that level so that that person in Chicago has an incentive to make sure that they are racing with everyone else who is at the top of the game from race to race to race. And that's kind of where I think it needs to be. Of course, even with saving money from not doing the UCI, it still comes to, where does this money come from? And that's the age-old question of cyclocross, and the way that mountain biking and Epic Rides solve it is they go to these really cool locations, and the locations know they're really cool, yet they want more people there, so the visitors bureaus have that money available. So part of it means that we may have to have cyclocross races in places that we ordinarily wouldn't to be able to attract those buckets of money.
Yeah, you know what? That sounds exactly, or not exactly, but almost like a gravel race, right? You have these really awesome locations that everybody wants to go to, and they want to pay $200 or more to participate in this race. And that's sort of how these Epic Rides are, right? They have an amateur field, and then there's sort of the, you can just, anybody can go into the pro field, right? I mean,
I'm not sure how that works. I think that may be true, but yeah, and it's sort of cool too, because the amateur races are all on Saturday, and then the pro races are on Sunday. So we don't even have the competition, you know, and the things that we're talking about in local and UCI races of having the amateurs and the pros sort of competing for the same course time. They're completely different days.
And I just wanted to add a point to, you know, saving money with the UCI, and obviously I'm speaking to the choir here and self, is that, like, yeah, save a chunk of that money and then invest that in a media team that gets you really great coverage. So yeah, so you go win this this cyclocross race that's not UCI, and you get on the podium and you're like, yeah, hey sponsor, I'm not ranked in the world, but here's some photos, here's a video with your logo all over it. You can follow, you know, it's on Twitter, like it's so available. So like building the, you know, we talked about last week about how Charm City was the perfect venue to film, and how, yeah, promoters, like, how do you make that part of your requirement for a course that it has to be capturable, you know, easily capturable by video, and that is part of the process. So
yeah, for sure. And I think that you're absolutely right. It's like, you can have the best stories in the world. I think that even I was just on kind of having this same conversation on Twitter, and somebody was making the point, I mean, probably flippantly, but he started out just by saying the stories will tell themselves. And I was like, point of order, Your Honor. The stories don't tell themselves. You know, I mean, look at, you know, I'm sorry, Chad, but look at Trek and Waterloo and the domestic, you know, the domestic outlets of traditional domestic outlets didn't even cover it. It's freaking World Cup. There's no coverage. So, you know, I mean, other than at least for cyclocross right now, poor Zach there, that's kind of the last guy.
You're a big part of it too, Bill. Come on. Don't be too modest. And we're teaming up now, apparently.
Yes.
So it's, but yeah, no, you are right. Like, I mean, I think, and well, this is the media pit. And so I guess we are kind of biased towards media, mm-hmm. but you know, there are people that are telling those stories, but at the same time, like, you know, you know, still having media or being able to tell those to a broader audience is super important. So
should we transition into that subject if we want, before we get into anything else we have to cover on the, I know I took us sort of off key of the World Cups. Anything else we want to cover on that subject?
No,
we could probably go on agreeing with each other for the next, you know, for the next hour. And I think, you know, Stephen Hyde, you know, he talked about in your podcast about he jumped into the firestorm or started it or whatever. I thought there was great discussion. I mean, it's awesome to see. That's what we love about the cyclocross community, is that we're willing and able to have those conversations. And, you know, as a community, I think everyone at the end of the day wants kind of the same thing, which is cross to succeed. And it's just a question of how we get there. So, you know, we could do this for an hour, another hour. So I think we can.
And I think sort of moving into DCCX, and it's something that we talk about, I think that it's a good transition from that. I mean, let's sort of pat ourselves on the back a little bit, and let's talk about the media response, especially, you know, from DCCX. And I think some of these other races and what the landscape looks like, and what other race organizers that may be listening to this can take from what we were able to do in DC and also in Charm City, and frankly also in Rochester and Go Cross, is that as an organizer, if you are willing to spend the money to have a media team, then that media team's obligation is to make sure that the news outlets, and quite honestly, in most instances, it's you, Zach, have the resources you need and the assets you need to tell the story. And you don't have a budget. I know this for a fact, that, you know, not to pull back the you know, the walls on this thing, but or the curtain, but there's not really a budget there. And I know that that's the fact for Velo News. I know that if there aren't Getty images available, Velo News isn't going to have a photo of your race. If and Cycling News, I mean, they're just a lost cause. We know they're going to go and find 4-year-old photos and plop it on any race they want. And I'm sure that they will say, well, we don't have the budget, or send us photos, which this is, if you as a race organizer are willing to do that, then you don't have to complain about it, because it happens. And I think that this is a huge, when you're putting on a race, here's my little primer for putting on a race. When you're buying your tape and you're paying your officials and you're looking at vendors, part of your budget should be how you are going to disseminate that message. Because if you want people to come to your race, you have to tell them about it. You have to tell those stories, and you need a team that you're paying to do that. And it's not You know, I will go up against anybody for DCCX and for Charm City as far as live Twitter goes. And we have a guy, Nate Graham, who I think is one of the best in the country at doing that. And
killed it.
And he's not doing it for a six-pack of beer. He's doing it for a daily wage that is good money. And that's important to me to hire him and to pay him to do that. And everybody knows about our race. And that's huge, you know, and I hire our mutual friend, Bruce Buckley, to take photos of these. And then those go out to sponsors and go out to Zach so he can get them on Cyclocross Magazine. And it's huge. And the payback we get on that is more people come to our race and more people talk about it. So it pays for itself. So that is my little, I am on so many soapboxes today. I am sorry. but that's my soapbox for race promoters.
Well, and I'm the editor, and so I don't 100% know our financials, but I will say this, like, our biggest, if you're looking at, like, as a publication, our biggest return on investment is going to the UCI website and posting race results, you know, in terms of, like, what people are most interested in having. And so far, it's hard, right? Like, it's not cheap to go to race weekends, and Bill, you do a great job of running your business and making sure that you cover it, and you should absolutely be commended for what you do. But at the same time, like, it becomes hard for us from a business standpoint, and so we pick and choose what we can cover. But, I mean, we will always work with organizers to publish material when it becomes available. And, you know, Bruce did a great, for example, we published a story about DCCX. Bruce took photos. You had your live tweeting. And I contributed some writing. I mean, I sat down and wrote a story because I knew how much work you guys put into it and what it meant to you. And I think, like, that we're willing to do that. And, you know, you guys are, like, the creme de la creme, but, like, there's tons of photographers out there. You could pay them a couple $100 and they'll give you images for your race. You know, you can get someone to go around with the microphone and, you know, pay them $50 and just get some quotes and send it to us. And we'll tell that story for you. You know, we'll put in the work, which is, I like to pretend my writing and work has some value.
It's the best out there, Zach. And that's not, well, that's, you know, it, that's not saying that it's just because no one else is doing it. I mean, I think you do a great job, and that's why, you know, Cyclocross Magazine has survived, because you give that kind of coverage.
Well, thank you. But I think you can't, like you're saying, you can't wait around and be like, oh, why isn't anyone covering our race? It's like, you know, and Adam and the North Victoria series do a great job of this. They hire someone. They send race previews, which we publish. Yep. They send good images, which we publish. They send race reports with good images that, you know, like that we publish. But like, they invest some money in that, and
yes,
they get a good return on their investment, because we want to provide the coverage. And, you know, like you said, it's a model, and it doesn't have to necessarily, you don't have to hire the official photographer of US Cyclocross in Bruce Buckley. You know, I mean, I just did this for my local race. Like, I have a teammate. He's like, why are you going around taking pictures? Well, we're promoting our race now. Well, guess what? We have great race photography, you know, to promote. Like, well, you have me on Cyclocross Magazine, but, you know, and it looks more pro. We were able to promote our race better because I invested the time and donated my photography to the race.
Yeah.
You know, so yes, I think you're right, but it is a lesson for organizers. We want to help you, especially if you can provide that. And it has value.
Yeah. And it helps also if you have like if you're racing in a tropical storm.
but I think you touched on the other thing, though, is the importance of building relationships, is like within, you know, within people in the media, with race organizers, with other, you know, photographers and stuff, is really the importance of relationships. And you guys were just like, you know, you hit me up. You're like, what do you need? Here's what we're sending. What else do we need? What's our timeline? And getting on me a little bit to get it up today, which I appreciate, which I'm willing to do, because we've built this good, strong relationship with one another. And so I think doing that groundwork and that legwork really paid off in terms of what you did.
Yeah. And that is the antithesis of a race organizer going onto Twitter and going, I don't understand why Cyclocross Magazine doesn't cover our event. What are they even here for? Which I know you see a lot of. Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, did you contact them? Did you send them stuff? Did you make their job a little easier to do? Did you give them the information on your race? And a lot of times is no, they didn't. You know, so it's Yeah, that's your job. It's, you know, we call them, I mean, the we're not allowed, that's a wrong way of putting that. We don't say race promoter anymore. Promoter is not the vernacular that is used. It's now race organizer. Well, we can't just totally push promoter off of the cliff. You know, you still have to be a promoter. You still have to promote your event. And part of it is if you want coverage, you got to do a little work to get it. No one's going to do it for you.
Yeah, well, and we saw that with, you know, I mean, Scott Page from Rochester should be commended. I mean, my gosh, like, he was in touch. He's like, what do you need from me? He was calling me. He's like, are we good? You know, and we worked together. You worked with him. And he was just very, like, I value this. This is important to me. And, you know, to the extent it was like, oh, man, we're talking to Scott again. But it was great because it showed that he valued those relationships and that he cared. And I think that he got one hell of a deal out of the coverage of that his race got this year.
Yeah, and to what Michael was saying, I think you're right. If you're going to have a national series, and it's kind of what we had a little bit when we had Peloton Sports that was working with USA Cycling, and maybe that, you know, model had some hiccups in it, especially since you're working with the federation and not a series. But, you know, what you were saying, Michael, is that if you're going to have a series, that's key. You know, that's really part of it. And there are many people out there, including yourself, Michael, that are ready, yeah, and available to provide those sweet, sweet images.
Still and moving all as well. And, you know, obviously I like to talk about it afterwards too. So I got to say, it's the media pit is a pit of joy.
Yes.
Well, and I will say this, though, too, about cyclocross, as I think we're in a bit of a unique place where I think, you know, race directors are going to get better value because we are still a sport of passion. I think there's so much passion behind what we do. And so you're going to get below market rate for what you're getting, you know, like the amount of money that Bruce Buckley should be commending for the work or getting for the work he does as well, you know, but he gets that because he cares, you know. And I think that there's opportunities there because we are foolish enough to care so much as a community behind the scenes.
Bruce, don't listen to him.
No one's working for less than they should be working for, Zach. Union strong over here, okay?
I wear too many hats in this one.
fair.
No, you're absolutely right. Just joking. All right, where should we move on to next?
Well, I had a question for you, Bill. We were I guess they call it on the Slow Ride Pod, the green room. You were talking about, you guys had phenomenal women's participation, especially I saw your 4-5 women's participation was just like through the roof, which is just incredible to see. And it's, you know, I think it's one of those areas that we look at as a sign of health in the cyclocross community is the number of women participating. But you talked about some work that you guys did behind the scenes to help promote that. So what did you guys do? To
it wasn't
help make that happen.
We cannot take credit for this other than that we live in a place that has a really strong local association that cares about these issues. One of the officers is specifically tasked with women's cycling, and she made a point of making sure that for our race and other MABR races, but really I think concentrating on our race since it's a marquee event in the Mid-Atlantic, of having clinics and raising awareness and making it, you know, not only easy but fun and attractive for our women racers who have never towed the line between the tape to who may race road to anything else, to hey, let's get out there, let's try cyclocross, it's a great community and you should be part of it. And yeah, we had 50 people out there for each day racing in the women's beginners. We had, I believe, overall like fields of 110 women, you know, it's something that is far and beyond what we've seen in the past. And again, all of the credit goes to the few people behind the scenes that work with our local association that, as you said, Zach, there's a lot of passion in this sport that wanted to make this a point of emphasis and not have, you know, we see enough promoters out there or race organizers who are like, oh, well, I can't have a women's race because no one's signing up, you know? And I don't think that's really, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy if that's going to be the attitude that you have towards it. But if you try to build something where it's inviting for people to show up, maybe that can change, because gender and sex shouldn't matter as far as having fun racing cyclocross. We've seen that that's really, really the case, you know, across the board. So I think from everything else that we had that was awesome about the weekend, just seeing that was, and it really hit home for me because somebody took a photo. We have this really nice results board that one of the DCMTB members built. It's really just this cool. If you've seen like the DCCX sign, like that huge wood worked sign, like the same guy that built that, you know, made that results board, which is also beautiful. And they had a picture of 2017 because at that time they were proud of it, of showing the women's field, and it was like half a page. And they did the same thing this year, 2 years later, and it's like two pages long. And it just, I saw that and I was like, that I think is my favorite image from the weekend, because that's just killer.
That's really encouraging to hear that, you know, because I think, you know, a lot of places, and especially in my area, the numbers of amateur races, it's just really, it's plunging. So I understand that it does take, it takes a lot of people and it takes work. Like, it's also like, if you're a race promoter, then you need to reach out to your governing body or other groups, and you need to make sure you don't just put on the event and be like, no one's coming, or even just throw money at it. It's like, you gotta put that infrastructure in place, but then you have to reach out to your community and really, like, yeah, put on those programs and grow it from the bottom.
Step one is to go to your local association, look at the officers that are there, and if you don't have something similar to a women's racing coordinator, that's what you need to change. That's kind of step one in this. And I know there are local associations that do not have that position filled or even thought about creating that position, and that's a big deal.
Huh. But that's a good point. I may have to get in touch with them. I'm actually curious in learning more of the nuts and bolts, and it's probably beyond this podcast, but I've just been thinking about it because, you know, we're doing some stuff at my local race. We're doing free entries for first timers. We're trying to recruit, you know, giving discounts to people from out of state to come to our race. And I'm just like, how do I get in touch with these people? And
I want to also talk about your race, Bill, and I want to talk a little bit about just the elite races. And, you know, you guys, you have highlights, and Zach, you have your article up, but I just kind of wanted to briefly chat about sort of, you know, the note I put in our agenda was horses for courses. And as we said, that, you know, you've had dry day and rainy day, Saturday and Sunday, a lot this year. Which is kind of hilarious, and it's really, everybody gets to have the cyclocross weather they want. But just speaking in the men's race, you saw Kerry Warner won on Saturday, and then it was a mud, a literal shit show on Sunday, and Stephen Hyde got his groove back. I mean, that was really cool to see, and we Hyde is the kind of guy, so we saw it at Nationals, that seemed like the conditions for him. Watching your highlights, you know, he's a runner, or he is a, I think he's a better runner than Warner. And, you know, Zach, you've asked the question of like, what, you know, what kind of rider is Kerry? And is he, is he not a mudder? Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Bill, do you have thoughts? You were on the ground, you were shooting video. Any more sort of insight into how that played out?
First, it's, you know, we saw the tweets from Curtis, I think, on Tuesday after Charm City, where he was kind of bummed that he made the decision not to not to race the other half of the series, and wish he had gone to DC, and just, we wish he had been there as well, because I think that would have been a whole another level of this. But we can only talk about, you're absolutely right, you know, horses for courses, we can only talk about who showed up. And if we looked at Charm, you know, it really was Curtis, Kerry, and Steven, and Curtis is out of the picture, so we're looking at Curtis and Kerry. And I think you're right. You know, one thing that we saw, the difference between DCCX and Charm City, just on its face, is DCCX is a much punchier course. It's, you know, you're having to accelerate out of turns. There's little ups and downs and a lot more off camber. So you're never really, you know, Charm's just this beautiful flow to it. And you can just, we had those long, just power sections, not boring sections, right in with the flow of the course, but where somebody like Curtis and even Kerry, as Zach has pointed out, that it really looks like, you know, Kerry has become a more powerful rider, we're able to just open it up. And here that wasn't going to be the case. And I think that, you know, going back to what Zach was saying in previous weeks, Michael, and what you allude to is that this isn't to say that Kerry Warner isn't a superb technical rider, because that is key at DCCX. And you save a lot of time being able to get around these turns and get on these off camber corners. And I always talk about the makeup of DCCX, be it the acorns that, you know, Kerry was talking about in his vlog, and just the dust and just the roots and everything else, in that even when it's bone dry, it's a slippery course. You know, I mean, you're still sort of sliding out of turns and having to recover. And on Saturday, when it's completely dry, that's where Kerry rules, you know, and Steven was right there, and they came around that first turn. And, you know, I would tell everybody to go watch Kerry Warner's vlogs, because I think we mentioned it before, but just the production value and just the storytelling and everything, really compelling and really just so much fun. And I think he's doing a wonderful job on there. So you can see about, you know, at least DCCX this week, but just continue to follow those. But that's what he's talking about. He's like, Hyde was right there with him the whole time on Saturday, and he sort of came around that last turn and was able to take it. It's one of these, I forget the European race what it is, but it has that kicker at the, you go pits, and then this big kicker, and then you make a right turn onto the pavement, and then it's a sprint for home. And I think there was, I think it was in a, it was in a Svennis years ago. About,
I can
like,
imagine with, that course, but I can't.
Yeah, and I think it was Vanderpool who actually like brake checked Wout,
yep,
like right coming up onto the lip.
I remember that.
And then just sprinting off. That's kind of what we have there, you know, as far as the ending goes. And it's not a like tremendously long sprint. So it really is a race to that tarmac. And once you get on that, I you know, we've had some really close sprints, but I don't, it's tough to come around. So that was day one. Day two, once the mud started, once the rain, it started raining. I got on course at about 5:45 and it was raining then, and it just got harder throughout the day. I mean, we just got dumped on. And the thing that we've always said about DCCX is, yeah, it doesn't matter if it rains, it doesn't get muddy. Never gets muddy here. It all just drains. It's all on this slope, and all the water just drains into the pond. You know, it's sort of, again, we talk about these bowls. It's another bowl, and everything just goes in the pond. That theory was disproved. It can get muddy, and we saw it. And Hyde was like, you know, he was in his element. It was just amazing to see, you know, from seeing him stretch out his back and all this pain at Charm City. Once that rain started, he was just off like a shot. And from lap one, that gap just continued to grow. And I think that if you listen to that conversation that I had with him, where he talks about, you know, just this sort of mental change he goes through when he races, and just how it's all, you know, I am going to kill everybody out here and make them suffer. We kind of saw that in full form. And it was really a clinic on how to ride those conditions from Steven. And then just, you know, he was able to tell the story about how his first elite race was on that course ever. And then getting his first race, his first win of the season. It was, it's such a great story, you know, and it was awesome to be a part of that and to have him do it at DCCX and sort of kickstart his season with a win there in epic conditions.
Well, I guess, you know, just the discussions we've had surrounding Fayette Cross, surrounding Charm, and now surrounding DCCX, which, Bill, obviously you've been at all of them, and we've been watching from afar and looking at results and watching your coverage. I mean, I think the discussion around Nationals is going to come down to conditions. I mean, I think we're seeing drastically different things happen with our top riders in different conditions. And, you know, Carey will be the first to admit, like, his running is not as strong as it is for Curtis and Steven. And we've seen that play out. Like, it gets muddy. Although I guess he did beat Curtis at Waterloo on day two at the World Cup Waterloo. But generally speaking,
yeah, but head to head, you have to go back to Louisville last year, right?
Absolutely. And Carey came in as like a podium hopeful and he did not achieve his goals. And I think that we're going to be having this discussion about three or four riders. If it's clean and if it's muddy, I think it could, for the men, could go back down to two.
And right? aren't we all just kind of looking at our Farmer's Almanac and Tacoma, Washington, and thinking that it's going to be muddy?
Hot take. It's going to be dry.
Oh, whoa, okay. Based on what? Are you just going out there? You're just going to say, hey, go back to, I don't even know what date it is.
I'm pulling up, you know, I kept a journal back when I lived in Portland, and I remember, no, this is a complete hot take. I'm based on nothing, but I think it would be hilarious if it was dry in Tacoma for Nationals.
Yeah. So I did that when we did our story about Chicago Nationals. It was like, what's the weather going to be? And I'm like, you know what? Like, as someone who studied water resources in graduate school, I'm like, I know where to find that information. And I think it came out like the median median weather was like 50 degrees for a December Nationals. If you look at like the last 10 years, was it snowy and cold for like four of them? Yes. Was it in the 60s for two of them? Yes. But like, so I'd be curious to see, at least going off historically, you know, what are the chances? And I think that'll make for good speculation. Because I think we are seeing different races occur in different conditions with our elite men.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Zach. And I think that's something to... That's also a really great storyline to pay attention to all year. It is sort of the weather and how it's changing in the country and how that affects riders and when they can be good and not. And there's a slight note here, Bill. Day two, Steven Hyde finishes in time of 56:59. You really trying to work, bring it down to 50 minutes for the elite men and bring the women to 50 minutes?
I think that's more of a long course and circumstances, and I think that they did get faster as the race went on. I'd have to check lap times, but I'll bet that's the case, and they kind of did the best they could to get it as close to an hour as possible.
I mean, from my standpoint in my dry chair in New Orleans, that's good enough. 56 minutes,
yep.
First an hour and 2 minutes, whatever, right?
Yeah, and it would have been probably an hour. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to pull up the lap times again, but it'd probably be like hour eight, hour nine.
So another, if we talk storylines, I mean, I think, you know, last year, Becca Ferringer won the Parkway CX Trophy. And she didn't win a race, and, you know, one that sticks out with her to her was when Sonny beat her in the sprint. And I remember, Bill, I think there might have been a Cyclocross Television episode from that race, and you were talking to him, and she mentioned it. She mentioned it in the post-race interview with Bruce. She was like, I was not letting this come down to the line. This year she was dominant. I mean, she dominated the series. A little bit different because Charm wasn't a C1, but I mean, she really asserted herself, especially I think the DCCX weekend. You know, you had some of those West Coast ringers who came out, and she won those races and won the series, even though, you know, she was telling herself, hey, I'm golden, I'm going to get this nice paycheck. But she went out there and did the thing. I thought that was really impressive.
Nearly in tears just of frustration last year, not being able to get any of the wins in the series and win the series. And I know that was something that she wanted redemption for this year and, you know, got it four times in a row. I think that, you know, we saw it in Go Cross with her win there, but with these four wins, this is kind of Becca Farringer learning to and becoming confident in winning races. And I think it's a huge turn for her. And you can say, yeah, maybe there was some competition missing, but I think psychologically that doesn't matter. And I think that this is going to be a huge confidence boost for her. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the men because those were much closer races where we really had four races in a row from the top to where it was pretty much determined who was going to win, you know, not too far in the race. And that's not to say that it was great to have Courtney McFadden there. And I think she gave her a good run for her money. And even in the muddy race, she was with her much longer. I mean, McFadden was just stoked on seeing that mud out there. She could not have been happier. She was like, oh, it's like racing at home, you know, and she gave her a good battle. But there was one rider and she was in the leader's jersey and she was really just a class above the rest for these two weekends.
Well, one interesting thing she said in her interview is she said, I think after day one, she's like, look, I've never come into the last lap with other riders and beaten them. You know, she's like, I did at Supercross last year. I kind of lost to Ruby West. I went down to the wire with Sonny Gilbert and I lost. And so I think for her, even on day one of DCCX, like going into the last lap with, I think it was three other riders and beating them, huge.
Yep. Yeah.
Huge. And, but just huge for her.
You know, it's getting that gap and still not leaving it to a sprint. You know, she was able to come through on her own, which I think is a huge deal. And great fields, you know, I mean, we talk about it, it was like, Becca won, Sammy Runnels. It was great to see her out here. She grabbed second on day one. Courtney McFadden was third. Raylan Nuss coming in fourth. Carla Williams, sort of our Virginia almost local favorite, in fifth place. Carolyn Nolan in sixth. Just a really, really strong field. And on the muddy day, you know, I see a little difference. And I think it goes back to what you were saying just about the men's field too. I mean, it's Michael, it's just horses for courses. And you had Becky winning and Courtney in second and Raylan in third and Carolyn Nolan in fourth. Sammy dropped down to fifth. Erica Zavetta had a great race in sixth. Jen Malik, it was good to see her name up there. She was in seventh place. And again, just really, really fun racing, despite how miserable it may have seemed at sometimes standing in the rain for that long.
Well, let's move on to the other big storyline of the weekend, and I think that is the Bern World Cup. Sort of jumping back into that storyline, a lot of storylines in that, you know, where was Magalie, you know, how is she going to perform after her strong Jingle Cross performance? You know, what about Katarina Nash, who was wearing the leader's jersey blank and she didn't put on tattoos. You know, how is she going to fare?
She wore her scarf.
Ah, interesting. Okay. I like that. That's great.
Yeah, the cliff bandana.
Oh, very good. That's great. You know, also, but like we were going to see some new Euro women into the World Cups who didn't come to the States. Anna Marie Wurst being one of them. Alvarado, also another one who's both of them had hot starts in Europe. So yeah, I was really excited for this race and, woke up bright and early, to watch it. And you know, my note was worst is best, which, you know, we will talk about the course in a bit, but like she kind of pulled a Vanderpool. I feel like she, I don't know if she got the whole shot. I think she did, but really just kind of ran away with it. And it was like kind of a done deal fairly soon. But good to see her win her first World Cup. I believe it's the J-Pow bump. Talking about media bumps, she had that interview with J-Pow on a GCN race. So I'm looking for these X factors and I'm playing into the fact that the good media coverage is part of it. You know, it's that, you know, maybe I'm biased. But you guys have some thoughts on Bern? Zach, I know you have lots of thoughts.
Uh-oh. Well, I think first, I mean, obviously, the EKZ tour, the amount of what they've done with it. I will say, I guess this was, there was another point that came up with the Visitors Bureau bill. I believe we covered that on the next episode of Grodio that's stewing in the podcast, whatever it is, cauldron of coming out. But I think we also talked about having gravel races and cross races. And actually, one of your guys, Lucas Flukiger, did the gravel race on Saturday and he did the cross race on Sunday. And he didn't do super well in either of them, but hey, he was out there doing gravel and cross. And I think we talked about that in the coming Grodio episode 8. But, you know, last year, the course looked like, I don't know, it looks like it's at a park. Looking at, there was kind of, I saw a landscape photo. There's kind of like, reminded me of Bowensa almost, where there was like this hill and then a very flat part, and it did not look the most interesting. I think it's the kind of course that we would criticize and call like a grass crit or something. But it rained this year and it got really treacherous. And so, you know, last year, one thing that was interesting to me is you have Anne Marie Wurst. Her Twitter handle is Anne Marie MTB, which kind of gives away kind of her proclivities. And she went into the last lap with Mariana Voss on a very fast, just fast, dry course last year. So it was a little bit different. So it was interesting to me that, you know, she kind of emerged, got a little bit of redemption by winning this year, but that she did so well. And I mean, I look at like another like great ride, not the kind of course that I expected Katie Keough to do super well on, right? Like necessarily. But, you know, she had a great ride. She was riding in the podium positions for a good part of that race. And so she had a really good, outstanding ride on a course. It was kind of a, just an interesting, interesting course to me, the way it was set up. And
yeah, it seemed like, you know, so it was, it wasn't muddy like maybe in DCCX, Bill, but it had rained, it got muddy. And then it was becoming really thick again, right? And you saw that, especially in the first lap, you saw, I mean, there are some sections where the riders could go super fast, and then they're going into a really chopped up, muddy section. And this kind of gets back up to the EKZ series. But like you see Magali just hit like a really like rough patch of mud, and then she kind of goes a little bit crazy, and you're like, oh no, please don't hit all those barriers. Like that's the other question now. There's like no tape on this course. It's all the barriers with the feet. But really it was like you had to, it was one of those like it's really grabs your front wheel and you just kind of have to hold on for dear life and hope you can pedal through it. But yeah, that was like, it was like a different, that definitely changed it. And once again, you know, Magali had a really tough day. Although she kind of salvaged it a bit, right? Because she's now still sitting second overall in the World Cup. What did you think, Bill?
I think that I am just listening to you all because I didn't actually get a chance to watch the race. But what I do know is that, and I just want you to sort of walk us through that moment you were just talking about with Magali, and it turned into sort of a heat check, hand check situation with
right.
Katie Keough as well.
So that's yeah. So yeah. So Katie is behind Magali, and they're kind of coming. They're coming down a hill towards the camera, and you see Magali kind of lose her front wheel and just goes super squirrely, catches it before the barriers, and here comes Katie Keough behind her, and it almost looks like it's going to be a push, like to keep her going, but it's also like I'm here, like I need to get by. Excuse me, I have some CX heat check rankings to move up on.
She gave her the Heisman.
That's awesome. Yes.
The old Desmond Howard, Desmond Howard in the end zone. It wouldn't be a media pit if we also did not consider the CX heat check power rankings implications. Ooh. I mean, we actually had a number of great rides by North American riders. First and foremost among those, I think it's worth talking about Katie Keough. She kicked off her Euro campaign last weekend, and she had like one okay result and one really not super great result at the, I believe, at the Super Prestige. You know, and one thing that came up in back during the World Cups, right, is we got this is like, hey, what's up with Katie Keough? And I think we were kind of like, oh, don't worry. just wait till World Cup burn, right about then when, you know, she's going to start kicking it into gear. And she looked like, again, looked like that Katie Keogh we saw at the end of last season when she was finishing seventh at Worlds, the one that we've seen, you know, win the US Cup CX series back in the day. Very assertive, was in the battle of the sub 5 foot category with Anna Kay, who had the best ride of her young career.
Yeah,
but that was pretty funny to see those two small in stature but big in talent and riding ability, you know, kind of battle it out. You know, Katie Compton was, you know, still kind of a question mark, right? We saw her win that one day at the US Open of Cyclocross. You know, last year she had a good race at Bern last year and then got sick. She finished sixth, despite having a really not good start. She was in like 40th place at one point, and she kind of motored her way up to the front, thanks in part to probably some of that thick mud. So she had a good ride. Katarina Nash finished seventh in the leader's jersey. So, you know, a lot of good rides and some results that I think will have some implications when the next episode of the heat check comes out.
So yeah, I've talked about this on the heat check, but just the way everything is weighted and how it all works is that this is at the heart of it. We want to see how North American racers are doing racing in North America. That's kind of what we want to shine a light on. There's enough other outlets to figure out what European racers are doing in Europe. They don't need our help to cover that part of the sport. So when we have our North American racers who race both in Europe and the US competing in Europe, we want to still be able to highlight those results and have them factor into the overall rankings, and that's what will happen this week. Now, how heavily that's weighted versus a domestic race, you know, there is a weight given to each of them, you know, and then we're, you know, it's a different scale. I think if somebody wins a World Cup, then that's definitely gonna have a much bigger effect. But if somebody, you know, like is sweeping races in the U.S., that may be weighted higher since it's a North American conceit. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see how it all turns out.
Yeah, I bet that algorithm is cooking in overtime right
it
now.
Is definitely something that has been just looking at the what's been getting churned out of there. It's definitely going through many, many, many iterations of algorithming.
Before we move on, I just want to point out women's podium. You had Anna Maria Wurst, Celine Del Carmen Alvarado in second, and Anna Kay in third. Anna Kay's 20, Alvarado's 21, Wurst 24. I mean, future of the sport right there.
Can I attempt to bounce a theory, an idea off you guys and see what you have to say?
Sure. Dribble away, Zach.
So I think if we look at the men's racing, right, we've seen bigger gaps, right? Like back in the day, the Svennis days, you saw these epic battles go into the last lap, but you know, it was some of the riders were a little bit older or whatever. And we've seen this total youth movement on the men's side. So we've seen more explosive riders. We've seen these bigger gaps open up, more explosive early races early on. The women, we're starting to see that too. And I think, you know, all the Euro races, we're just seeing complete blowouts in so many of these women's races where even back up to last year, 2 years ago, we kind of had your Nikki Brandmeiers, your Helen Wymans, you know, even your Lucinda Brands, a little bit older, different racing style would go into the last lap. So I just kind of wonder if we're seeing before our eyes a little bit of a change in terms of how the racing is occurring, you know, because like Katarina, she talked about at World Cup Waterloo. She's like, I wasn't going to start with all those young kids. They're just out of the gate going crazy. And so I just kind of wonder, you know, we're seeing this youth movement on the women's side, if maybe that's affecting the style of racing that we're seeing. Because, you know, I mean, we've been, you know, Bern was over in 4 minutes.
I think, you know, it's one of those things where you don't really know what you can do until someone else does it. And then you're like, I got to try it. And it's not like this is a new thing, but seeing Vanderpool attack from the beginning or go so early and just stick it, like, you know, really hold it and stick it, you know, maybe it opens a door for a lot of athletes to be like, okay, yeah, like that's an effort I can try, or that's something that I can train and do. And you know, it also just might be one of those things here where Anne-Marie Wurst, just like, these are the conditions that really suited her. And, you know, Alvarado kind of had, I think I'm getting confused with the Super Steeds race where she crashed a bunch. But yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting theory though, Zach.
Well, at Heaton, she just blew the field away. I mean, that race was over in two laps. Yeah. You know, I didn't watch Boom, so I'm not sure what happened there. But it seems, you know, I don't know, you saw Evie Richards, that she couldn't hold it at Waterloo, but Evie Richards got out to a fast start there. I don't know. It's an idea that I had, and I was just looking at those ages and how young. You know, there's just so many young, especially Dutch women. They're really moving up to the upper echelon. So it's a theory. Folks who are listening, you guys have been great about chiming in. My pronunciation of Ely Easerbeat.
I'm even going Ailey. I heard Ailey. I heard somebody call him, one of the other riders call him Ailey. Ailey.
Oh. So. Anyway.
I will say this. So Jim Arenas finished 13th in the men's race, and he was 2 minutes and 4 seconds down. And then you go to the women's race, 13th place, Mannion Baker was 2 minutes and 19 seconds down. If you really, you know, again, they're a 15-minute shorter race, but if you look at the time gaps, they're kind of similar between the men and the women. So I don't know if that supports your argument, what you're saying, Zach, or not, but it's at least for this race, it seemed like, even though it was over early, the field stayed together. We weren't seeing these 4 or 5 minute gaps after like the top 10. They kind of stayed together after the front. But it also, just looking at the time gaps, it looks like what may have made it, and again, I didn't watch it, less compelling, was it didn't look like it was pack racing. It looked like it just kind of spread out, and then it was sort of people time trialing for the last couple laps.
Yeah, there was kind of a battle for third, fourth, fifth for a bit. Like Yara Kastelein crashed on the little, that very interesting feature. You had a choice between, you had a choice between hopping over a concrete fountain edge, it seemed like, or you could go hard to the left and take a bridge, and she just wiped out on the bridge, and that's
sounds more like a Mario Kart game than a.
It does.
Well, that course is very Mario Kart-ish.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my hot take. That's my theory, my hot take for the week.
Interesting. We'll have to watch.
So yeah, just briefly, the men's race, a little bit better racing, as in we didn't have one rider off the front, although at some point Ellie did go off the front and held it to the end. But we saw some more team tactics. It seemed that Van Turnout was off the front and maybe working for his teammate, and had the Telnet boys had to chase him down. And then once they caught him, Ellie went, and that was it. So once again, taking Zach to use your phrase, taking their lunch, and. 3 for 3 in the World Cups.
Yeah, it just truly, and again, we're not going to do it this episode either because we're already coming up on 1:30, but, you know, we do need to have that super team conversation. And you look at the, not even, who cares about names? I mean, this is your top 10. Powell, Sausen, Telenet, Kriafin, Powell, Sausen, Telenet. You know, and then, Philippe Bort's got in there at 15, and then it's Powell's. And then, you know, the poor Corned and Circus guys without a Vanderpool are coming in. They're just got a little team ride going at 18th and 19th, you know, the third team in Belgium.
So you're saying that Gianni is our hope. Gianni is our Vermeersch, huh?
Yeah. Either him or Urus.
Yeah, Tim Merlier's back with his road power, but yeah, it's been few and far between in terms of those interlopers who aren't on those two teams.
Speaking of power teams, you know, let's not forget the 777 team over on the women's side, who has Wurst, Arzufi, and Yara Kastelein, and really have been dominating at the front of the race lately. So,
yeah,
we'll throw them into the mix.
Was it, which race did they take the top two spots at? Was it?
Was that Boom?
I was going to, hold on. Looking. Boom. No, because no. it was the two Italians. It was the two Italians at Boom. Anyway, there was one race where the, I was hoping I could say that the 777 team dropped the Boom on the field, but it was actually the Italians who did it.
And on that note.
Super Prestige, so.
Michael, what do you got going on?
I you find me at Yeah You Ride on Instagram. Also find me at Twitter on at Land Softly and tell me how to pronounce names. Bill, thanks again for having me on the show.
Zach, what's going on in the world of cyclocross?
Yeah, I'm the Shoe Star. I'm at cxmagazine.com. We produce shit. This week we just post stuff that Bill produces, but what can I say? he's doing a great job of putting out content. So, you know, it's been cool. I look forward to hearing from more folks. And I guess we've tried a little different format, a little less race content, a little bit more commentary. So definitely know what you think about what we're doing. And if you have topics you want us to cover, because we would love, I love suggestions. It makes it easier, right?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what we have going on here with how calling it the Media Pit. And I think part of what we sort of wanted to do with these episodes is what you're listening to is a lot of what the conversations are when we're after a race in the media room. And this is it.
Yeah.
If it's going to be, and it can go from race coverage to what happened in the race to these more, you know, bigger picture ideas about the sport itself. So I'm kind of digging it. Sort of brings us back to the races. So this is your insight. You know, you have these podcasts that are like, I think like the Two Johns podcast was always, this is what it's like when we're coming home from races as racers. Well, this is what it's like for us when we're sitting in the media room processing photos and writing stories. I will say that if you want to get in touch with us, which you can do it at feedback@cxhairs.com. Also, you can get in touch with me at cxhairs on most social medias. And go check out the Heat Check when it comes out on Thursday. It'll be at youtube.com/cxhairs. So for Michael and Zach, I'm Bill. This is the Media Pit, and we'll see you on the next one.